The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. Welcome to Salute a Veteran Every Day. And due to a communication snafu, our guest for today will not be here. So I'm going to read from Air Force Magazine, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. This is called Go Beyond, a legacy of partnership committed to the future. For more than six decades, Pratt & Whitney has powered the U.S. Air Force's B-52 bomber, and they're fully committed to keeping this critical aircraft mission capable for the next 30-plus years. As the time comes to replace the B-52's engines, only the Pratt & Whitney PW-800 will give what the Air Force needs, a robust commercial engine with unparalleled fuel efficiency and significantly lower sustainment costs. They are the only engine provider with the experience needed to keep the Stratofortress fleet in fighting shape. And I thought this was interesting, a timeline of the B-52. 1952, the U.S. Air Force's B-52 Stratofortress makes its maiden flight, powered by eight Pratt & Whitney J-57 engines. Now, I know people who really can talk about these names of engines, J-57 and so forth. I don't go that deep on it myself, although I was in the Air Force. 1961, the B-52H, the final variant of the aircraft built, enters service with Pratt & Whitney TF-33 engines. 1991, B-52s deliver approximately 40% of all ordnance dropped by coalition forces during Operation Desert Storm. The 2000s, B-52H aircraft play a key role in the 9,000-plus total airstrikes conducted on targets between mid-2014 and the end of 2016. And 2050, coming up, the B-52H remains one of the most versatile aircraft in the Air Force fleet. And it's pretty amazing that this aircraft, which is older than any of its pilots flying it, continues to be a vital part of our defense system in the United States. From an old aircraft to a new aircraft, an MQ-9 Reaper on the line at Creech Air Force Base, Nevada. Remotely piloted vehicles are changing the way the U.S. and its allies wage asymmetrical war. We're going to read from The Unique Advantages of Remotely Piloted Aircraft. And there's a picture here of airmen on with the sun just rising in the background. It's either rising or setting. I think it's rising. And this article is by Lieutenant Colonel Johnny Duray, Implications for Future Warfare. When an MQ-1 Predator fired an AGM-114 Hellfire missile in the opening stage of Operation Enduring Freedom over Afghanistan, the world discovered a new form of power projection, kinetic force delivered from unmanned, remotely piloted aircraft. And by the way, there are unwomened too, because men and women fly these things from the ground. The proof of concept drove exponential growth in RPA usage, with combat patrols swelling from just four in 2004 to 65 simultaneous worldwide CAPs, or combat air patrols, every day in 2014. Yet there is still more work to be done to fully realize the power of RPA technology. As the new National Defense Strategy focuses on an era of great power competition, RPAs will provide valuable capabilities and capacity to address the consistent threat posed by violent extremist organizations. In doing so, RPAs will also allow other portions of America's air arsenal to focus on near-peer competitor challenges. Achieving this goal requires a new vector for the use of RPAs, as illustrated in the vignettes that follow. Though details have been obscured for operational sensitivity, the narratives and lessons remain largely intact. In one recent RPA mission, intelligence sources helped the U.S. military discover a remote jihadi training facility. Plans called for eliminating the radicals with air power. Leaders initially sought bomber aircraft for the strike, which required scheduling and positioning refueling aircraft, obtaining overflight clearances, and coordinating for personnel recovery, all time and resource-intensive factors that didn't apply to the RPA, already providing persistent intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance overhead, as explained in RAND publication, Armed and Dangerous, UAVs and U.S. Security. When bombers proved unavailable, a four-ship formation of fighter aircraft was requested. This option necessitated an even more robust support structure, as the fighters needed to forward deploy closer in theater. This also required a massive undertaking involving the movement of support personnel and equipment, despite the fact that multiple armed MQ-9 aircraft were already conducting daily surveillance and intelligence missions in the vicinity of the camp. Two environmental factors introduce further complexity into this mission. First, the camp was embedded deep inside a canyon with a valley floor only 15 feet wide. Any air-launched weapon would need to be precisely aimed to strike the narrow space between the canyon walls. Second, the jihadis were broken up into two distinct groups, 2 to 3 miles apart. A first-run attack would require delivery of simultaneously effects. I think those are bombs. Re-attacks on survivors would need to be conducted expeditiously. Once the bomber and fighter options proved unavailable, leaders finally selected 4 MQ-9 Reapers to execute the mission. Reaper 1, Reaper 2, and Reaper 3 were flown by squadrons in the same location, while Reaper 4 was flown by a squadron at a separate location. The first two Reaper crews planned, briefed, and executed as a formation, or flight, bringing the geographically separated Reaper 4 into the planning as much as possible before execution. The 4 Reapers were equipped with 2 500-pound GBU-12 laser-guided bombs and 16 air-to-ground Hellfire missiles. Reaper 1 teamed with Reaper 4 to make a run on the first target group, dropping the 500-pound bombs. Once established inbound, Reaper 1 passed an estimated bombs-on-target time to Reaper 2 and Reaper 3, which targeted the second group of terrorists in training with 4 Hellfire missiles in order to achieve simultaneous effects. The synchronicity was near perfect. Weapons impacts from the bombs on the first group and the Hellfires on the second group were within a second of each other. The 4 MQ-9s hit 2 separate target sets with 6 munitions on 4 different aim points with a time on target calculation formulated as the mission progressed, based on outside clearance authority. Reaper 2 and Reaper 3 teamed up to immediately re-attack the survivors. Prior planning, internal communication, and near real-time data sharing enabled an unprecedented display of efficiency. RPA pilots physically located together can speak into each other's headsets without delay on an intercom channel, for example. Reaper 3 rifled off all 4 of its Hellfires on 3 separate re-attacks in under 7 minutes. In one instance, Reaper 3 fired a Hellfire on a group of terrorists without having ever seen it, since Reaper 2 had tracked the group and provided final weapons guidance for Reaper 3's missiles. Reaper 1 and Reaper 4 were left to conduct re-attacks as solo aircraft, since they lacked the prerequisites for the seamless integration enjoyed by Reapers 2 and 3. As such, They were only able to employ three of their available eight Hellfires in the first 16 minutes following the initial strike. The final attack was conducted 2 hours later when Reaper 3 found a group of eight Army combatants hiding in a small ravine. Out of munitions, Reaper 3 talked the crew of Reaper 4 on the ground. The terrain only allowed a window of approximately 20 seconds for an MQ-9 to provide final guidance onto the target before becoming masked by the rocks. Reaper 4 shot a Hellfire into the ravine, target unseen, while Reaper 3 came in from the opposite direction, crested the terrain, and timed the aircraft's positioning so that final guidance was placed on the enemy group in the last 10 seconds of the missile's flight. By the conclusion of the mission, some 85% of the combatants were killed, with the other 15% wounded. Some of the lessons learned from this operation: 1. The MQ-9 Reaper delivers unique capabilities in combat. The Reaper's slow airspeed permits more time to strike targets in steep or inaccessible terrain, while supersonic fighters and bombers permit only brief execution windows before sensors and targeting capabilities are masked. Nevertheless, the training required to take advantage of this capability is akin to the demands for manned aircraft crews. The range and effectiveness of present-day RPA strikes is possible because of the robust training, U.S. Air Force Weapons School caliber planning, and RPA technological advances made since 2001. 2. Remotely piloted aircraft provide synergistic effects when employed together as a flight. The idea of operating RPAs in a flight is still new. Operational planners typically task the closest RPA available just prior to the execution of a complex strike, requiring extensive coordination among the participants. But an RPA flight generates synergistic effects, just like manned aircraft, through a mutual understanding of responsibilities and a shared awareness of the battle space. This is best cultivated through extensive pre-strike planning and briefing, along with real-time information sharing during execution. Bringing together single aircraft from separate squadrons just before a mission ignores the lessons of air power history in the name of convenience. 3. Decentralized execution is fundamental to successful RPA application. RPAs present an unprecedented opportunity for reach-in. With unparalleled observation and communication capabilities, commanders at all levels have violated the long-held tenet of decentralized air power execution and exerted direct control. 4. Focus on platforms rather than effects stifles RPA operations. The fluid, dynamic nature of kinetic engagements demands mission command orders that rely on tactical expertise and the situational awareness of those employing the aircraft. Yet effects are what matters in operations, not platforms. As long as commanders tie specific aircraft to specific missions rather than desired effects, RPAs will continue to be underutilized. RPA aircrews routinely participate in operational planning sessions where the capability to position fighters overhead to provide close air support is deemed a go/no-go factor by ground and air planners alike. When queried to elaborate on desired effects, ground force representatives routinely reply that they want air power to assist in breaking contact with the enemy to facilitate return to safety. Although a flight of MQ-9s armed with a dozen Hellfire missiles and a few 500-pound bombs could achieve this effect, planners continue to revert to their default understanding that only aircraft with an A, F, or B designation can provide effective close air support. the 15-second window. A well-protected terrorist leader presented a very limited window for aerial attack. A successful strike had to take place within a narrow 15-second window when the target departed a highway on his motorcycle, but before he entered the courtyard of his home. Adding to the complexity, the target had a choice between two routes during that 15 seconds. And then there's a diagram here of the Reapers from the air closing in on the bad guy. First, Reaper 1 is the lead aircraft and begins timing calculations to maneuver into position. Reaper 1 views Reaper 3's video feed to determine if the target will be delayed at the intersection. They can see the motorcycles coming up on an intersection. 3. Reaper 3 watches the intersection on Route B. Motorcyclist takes Route B. Reaper 2 sends targets direct and speed while Reaper 3 updates intersection traffic. Reaper 1 maneuvers into the 15-second window and eliminates the target with no collateral damage. 2. Reaper 2 follows the target motorcyclist as he travels to the engagement site. And that was from a drawing, an illustration here of how they take out the bad guys while putting great effort on lack of collateral damage. 15 second lessons learned. The success of this strike was made possible by a flight-focused operations approach paired with an intensive training program and truly decentralized execution. It also introduced three new areas to reflect on. Data sharing brings asymmetrical advantages to bear in modern warfare. The strike on the senior terrorist was heavily reliant on real-time data sharing between aircrews, which allowed the flight to get inside the adversary's decision loop and reorient quicker than the adversary. Second, risk acceptance enables rapid advancement. The rapid acceleration of software and some hardware enhancements have enabled RPA airmen to execute kinetic engagements that would not have been proposed just 5 or 6 years ago. These capabilities were largely possible because the RPA community's close working relationship with industry allowed it to accept imperfect solutions in the name of accelerated capability. Third, tactical oversight offers enhanced RPA capabilities. The ability of an MQ-9 squadron to place additional personnel on a ground control station to support a traditional two-person crew transforms what that aircraft can bring to bear in combat. This tactical oversight boosts the capability of the crews, elevating success rates for complex engagements. This is especially important since in modern operations, the MQ-9 pilot has neither a flight lead nor an experienced aircraft commander to rely on for decision-making. In most cases, as a result of years of surging RPA demand. Here's the vignette, The Attempted Rescue. On one calm, moonless night a few years ago, a small group of U.S. Special Operations Forces parachuted from a transport aircraft on a hostage rescue mission. Overhead, three MQ-9s and a U-28 manned ISR aircraft provided support to the SOF team from insertion through the rescue operation and exfiltration. The three MQ-9s were co-located and operated out of the same RPA operations center where small staff stood up to support the three flying crews. As the SOF, Special Operations Forces, SOF, as the SOF team worked its way toward the hostage's reported location, it became apparent to the RPA Operations Center director that real key-time intelligence was taking too long to get to the ground forces via the Joint Operations Center, the main mission hub. The MQ-9 elements overhead, had direct radio contact with ground forces, and, more importantly, instant access to the intelligence as well. After a quick discussion about transferring responsibility from JOC leadership to MQ-9 pilots, the time frame for essential intelligence processing to ground forces went from a minute to under 5 seconds. A U-28 aircrew member was pre-positioned inside the ROC, R-O-C, not sure what that stands for, to provide subject matter expertise on the ISR aircraft, as well as techniques, tactics, and procedures to the MQ-9 crews and staff. Unfortunately, as the team arrived at the location, it discovered that the hostage had been moved from the village just prior to the raid. However, the event offered a real-world opportunity to explore several underutilized capabilities that the RPAs and the Operations Center could apply to future missions. Attempted rescue lessons learned. First, RPA's ability to port talent into any cockpit at any time is unprecedented in the history of air power. Because of the physical setup of the ground stations that operate RPAs, any individual can enter the airplane while airborne. That's because they're being controlled by the ground, of course, on the ground. In this example, a U-28 expert was brought in to assist with airborne integration. Airborne integration could also be extended to fighters, bombers, and any number of other assets. Ground forces could send delegates to a ROC to educate and enable integration between RPAs and supported surface elements. Second, RPA operations centers are uniquely positioned to fuse and disseminate information. These centers allow operational directors to seamlessly communicate face-to-face with the aircrews that provide a majority of the center's data. It is the equivalent of a combined forces air component commander while in charge of an AOC, Air Operations Center, being able to jump into the cockpit of any manned aircraft under his authority. Additionally, the land-based setup of the GCS, ground-controlled, enables an RPA cockpit to connect to modern combat untethered by bandwidth and connectivity limitations that plague most airborne manned aircraft. The way forward for RPAs, these three vignettes provide substantial food for thought about how RPA expands the flexibility and capability of air component commanders. This leads to four critical implications that DOD leaders and Air Force officials should consider. First, reconsider air power force posture in the fight against violent extremist organizations. In the light of changing national priorities and finite resources, it is imperative to find ways to sustain the counter-extremist mission in a more cost-effective manner. Investment in information sharing will bring transformational advantages. As a whole, the U.S. military must tear down parochial walls and allow information between disparate elements of hard power, tanks, ships, aircraft, infantry, and other forces, to flow more freely. And number three, airmen must understand and articulate appropriate command and control relationships for RPAs to fully realize the potential of present and future RPAs in combat. Airmen must operate any effort to centralize execution and challenge command structures that fail to place airmen in positions where their air-mindedness could maximize the Air Force's contribution to joint operations. In other words, airmen should influence air power decisions at all levels of warfare. Four, expand RPA mission sets to include close air support. MQ-9 capabilities and tactics have reached a stage where planners need to rethink allocation for key missions, especially close air support. RPAs have transformed both the amount of firepower they bring to bear on the battlefield and the speed at which this ordnance can be delivered. Despite this, the MQ-9 is still predominantly regarded across the Air Force as an ISR asset and rarely incorporated in close air support scenarios. According to the Air and Space Power Journal article, a mission ISR plan is completed on a different timeline by different people in a different division in the Air and Space Operations Center and published in a different document. If close air support and ISR integrate, they do so by luck. While not all CAS scenarios are appropriate for MQ-9, military planners should embrace an effects-based perspective and try to minimize platform-centric bias. Fifth, RPAs and their associated operations centers present an ideal platform for entry-level, multi-domain exploitation and rapid acquisition trials. Compared with traditional aircraft, RPA cockpits offer a prodigious amount of space and connectivity. Limited only by bandwidth and imagination, RPA offers unique opportunities to take advantage of multi-domain exploitation and use rapid acquisition capabilities to further the state of the art. In current combat operations, the Air Force's MQ-9 is as different from its Operation Enduring Freedom era 2001 MQ-1 forebearer as an F-16 is from a P-51. However, this transformation has collided with cultural differences rooted in traditional notions of force deployment, both in the air and on the ground. This has led to suboptimal utilization and investment considerations. Today, fighters and bombers are no longer the only option for mass strike, and RPAs are no longer just airborne sniper rifles. RPAs can effectively conduct close air support, particularly with small ground team elements like Special Operation Force units. These two considerations alone should cause the U.S. military leaders to rethink American force posture for the flight against violent extremist organizations. This article was written by Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Johnny Duray, a senior pilot with more than 3,200 flight hours in the MQ-9 and U-28 and extensive experience in combat and combat support missions. The opinions expressed in this article are the authors alone and do not reflect those of the Department of Defense or U.S. Air Force. Well, that's our cue. We've run out of time for this month's Salute a Veteran Every Day. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. See you next time. We'll be right back.